At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
I'm Kai Riznall, and this is a Marketplace special broadcast, The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time. Yes, the markets have been everywhere these couple of weeks, but please keep calm and carry on.
We follow the stock market because it's instant. But if you dig down a little deeper, you'll see that the path of the stock market very rarely follows the path of the actual economy.
Ah, the actual economy, the one that's stuck in neutral. Almost 4 years after the recession started, what I'm about to say won't surprise you. Problems number one, two, and three, jobs, jobs, and jobs.
The adults in the job industry are staying in their jobs longer, and so young people coming out of college don't have a place to really fit in. And so it's just kind of keeping your arms open and trying to reach whatever you can out in the job market.
What the heck happened? And what do we do now? This hour on Marketplace, The Breakdown from APM, American Public Media. This is a Marketplace special, The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time. I'm Kai Riznall. Good to have you with us. There's this thing we do on the show every weekday. A lot of people take it as a kind of an instant summary of the economic day. Maybe you've heard it. And let's face it, the numbers do give one impression of the economy. How bad can things be when Marketplace is playing the happy music, after all? In a lot of ways, since the recession began and since it ended, the recovery has been about the markets. Corporate profits bounced back. So did their share prices. Retirement funds and college accounts got back almost to where they'd been. But the economy's not the markets, and the markets aren't the economy. There are still almost 14 million people out of work in this country. The housing market is flat stuck. People haven't really been spending. And then this happened. All right, gang, deep breaths. We're just going to do this and get it over with. The Dow Industrials plunged 5.5% today, 634 points, 10,809 at the bell. The NASDAQ crumbled 6.9%, 174 points, 2357 the number. All it took was a fight over the debt limit, S&P and the downgrade, and all of a sudden the bottom fell out. Fell out of the markets and about what people thought about the economy. The Dow was off more than 600 points that Monday, and then came Tuesday. Yeah, that's a little number we like to call the sad happy music, because really after the drubbing we've been taking, 429 points up on the Dow today ain't nothing. Everybody started paying attention again. What's happening? How do we get here? Where are things going? The answer has a lot to do with things you can't just put a music bed under. Jobs and European debt, the global economy and our place in it. The story of the economy has become the story. And it's not just about financial markets. It's about individuals and families, small businesses and corporations, retirees and the middle class, political leadership and economic choices. Some context and some answers coming up this hour.
I think a lot of people operating out of fear. Right now, everybody's worried about the future. So it's like, how can I hold on to what I have?
That was Gregory Jones from Nashville, Tennessee. So let's, as we get going, turn to those markets I was just talking about, because they are, for better or worse, the representation of economic health for a lot of people. And even if you do account for what they really represent, when they tank like they've been doing, 401ks and college funds and all the rest lose a lot of money. There is actually a word for the craziness we've been seeing lately: volatility. You can even trade something called the VIX index, an actual quantified measure of how crazy the markets are. Here, though, for some market sanity is our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Hey, Heidi.
Hi, Kai.
So give me your sense, would you? What was the past 2 weeks of our economic lives. What happened?
It was all a dream, like in a bad sitcom. It was a lot of fireworks and a lot of storminess, but we are basically right back where we started. And I think that makes it a really good cautionary tale about not buying into the hype every time that there is hype.
Well, that's a good lead into my next question, which is to ask you to comment on this phrase. The markets are not the economy, and the economy is not the stock markets. Compare and contrast.
Yes, it's like you have been reading my diary. They are not comparable at all for various reasons. We follow the stock market because it's instant and because, in some sense, economic data is not just slow, but it's unreliable. But if you dig down a little deeper, you'll see that the path of the stock market very rarely follows the path of the actual economy. That's because investors don't look at things like the consumer price index when they invest. They look for corporate earnings, and corporate earnings are more separate from the real economy than we think. We've obviously seen a lot of very profitable companies with a ton of cash, whereas a lot of us are experiencing this economic malaise where there's a lot of unemployment. So we're in this divided, or what economists might call a bifurcated economy. And it's important not to just go for the easy answer, which is what the stock market provides.
Help me then find, and this is kind of a grand question, the fundamental truth. I mean, how do we know? What do we look at? What are we supposed to do?
Well, we know that the biggest problem right now is jobs. Mm. If we get more people employed, we'll see rises in tax revenue. We'll see greater growth in consumer spending. You'll see the housing market start to rebound a little bit as people are able to pay down their debt. Basically, you'll know when things are getting better by looking at the really big issues, at unemployment, at housing, at deleveraging of American households, which means how fast are we paying down debt.
You mentioned looking at the really big issues. I want you to, just because we're going to talk about it a little later on this hour, look at another really big issue, which is our place in the global economy. We are not doing well. Other places, though, are doing worse, and so we look not so bad, if that makes any sense at all.
That's absolutely true. And what we have to realize is that we're at an almost unique point in human history. This is a global slowdown. A couple of weeks ago, as you know, there was a huge bank panic where people thought a major French bank might go under or might be in trouble.
Yeah, and it ended up
exactly. And it was based almost completely on rumors. And those rumors managed to affect U.S. banks, which only because we don't have any reliable information on how exposed our U.S. banks are to European banks. And that goes for the whole financial system. All we know now is that we are deeply interconnected, and we have a long way to go before we truly understand how deeply interconnected we are.
You are sitting right now a brief subway ride from the corner of Wall Street and Broad. You talk to bankers and traders and investment professionals every single day. Are they as worried about the state of the economy as it seems a lot of people around the rest of this country are?
Well, I think a lot of them really have long memories. When I was talking to people during the panic 2 weeks ago, I was asking them, is this the worst that you've ever seen? Hmm. And surprisingly, the answer was no. Many of them remembered the, you know, fuel crisis of the 70s, and other people remembered, you know, times when the prime rate, the federal lending rate, was around 18%. So we have been in really bad places before, but things have a way of being cyclical in this economy. The biggest mistake, I think, is to believe that anything that happens is permanent. So this is going to be bad, but we could use this as a very productive time to help fix things. And that's what I hear from a lot of investment professionals. They're obviously trying to keep their heads about them, and they get worried when they see the market go up and down like everybody else. But then they wonder, all right, how do I react? How do I prepare? How do I make it better next time? And that's a good lesson for all of us.
Heidi Moore, our bureau chief in New York City. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Guy.
You know, we've had some fluctuations, and I feel this isn't 100% time to panic.
That was Luis Rubalcaba out of Seattle, Washington, right there. There is a very back-to-the-future feeling about what's going on out there right now. Back to March 6th, 2009, if you really want to nail it down. The Dow Industrials closed at 6,626 that day, the lowest the blue chips had been in a decade. There are a lot of similarities between today and the worst of the financial crisis. Wild market swings, a desperate housing market, a flight to the safety of treasury bonds, gold going up, and high unemployment. But so far, this isn't 2009. And just to be clear, there's no reason to think it might be. We did, though, figure it would be worth looking back at what happened then, because it does have a direct bearing on where we find ourselves now. For that, we've got our senior editor, Patty Hirsch, in the studio with us. Hey, Patty.
Hello, Kai.
So you have 30 seconds to explain what happened in 2008.
Okay. Well, the bubble burst.
All right, that was fast. The housing bubble.
Yeah. Well, you remember how high housing prices went? That was because debt was cheap and easy to get, and it was everywhere, in our retirement accounts, our pension funds, our banks, even our local governments. So indirectly, we all owned a piece of that debt. Debt that, when the housing market collapsed, was suddenly worth a lot less. So we all suffered, but no one suffered more than the banks, because they had gorged on debt during the good times, and now they were choking on it. So the government stepped in with its Heimlich maneuver.
Which was the $700 billion thing that we call the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Indeed, okay. That and TALF and all those programs designed to inject cash into the banks. So the Federal Reserve realized the banks needed cash to survive, and it bought vast amounts of that junky debt, essentially shifting the debt burden from the private sector to the public sector.
And hallelujah, the banks were saved.
It saved the banks, yes. And today they're doing a lot better. Not great, but better.
Yeah, but it's degrees of success, right? Because the economy is not having that same success.
Yeah, the economy is still struggling. See, two things happened after the banks were saved. First, the housing market failed to recover.
Right.
So everything connected to it ran into trouble. Construction, home furnishings, DIY stores, appliances, gardening stores, you name it. Everything took a really big hit, including local governments whose tax revenues evaporated. So stores and factories closed, schools and libraries cut back. People got laid off. Unemployment, as we know, scorched higher.
But, hey, the banks were all right.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't see it that way, though. The cash was coming in from the bank right enough, and the politicians were telling them to lend.
Right.
But they were also being told to hold more reserves and to be more conservative.
Which is the very definition of mixed message, right?
Yeah, so that made them very gun-shy, and they still are. But they weren't the only ones. Companies were skittish too, right? They didn't want to take the risk of expanding or hiring in a down economy when the future was so uncertain. And the same went for consumers. See, nobody wanted to borrow much. The banks didn't want to lend much. Stalemate.
And that gets us to August of 2011. Banks aren't lending as much as everybody wants them to, but by the same token, people, consumers, aren't really spending.
Exactly right. Lending standards are easing a bit for companies, but not for most individuals. But anyway, people are scared stiff about borrowing right now. They don't know if they're going to get laid off in 6 months.
Yeah, okay, but there's an upside here, right? Because while, and I realize this is sort of, you know, faint praise, but companies are doing fine even though consumers aren't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of money on company balance sheets, so people are still buying some stuff, which means companies are obviously making some money, but those companies aren't spending that money. They're not expanding, they're not hiring, so the private side of the economy, because of the lack of demand on the consumer side, is stuck. And the public side isn't doing much better. Because remember all that debt, okay, that the government bought from the banks?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it still exists. Like the billions of dollars in AIG debt that we took on to save that particular company, we still own that, and that makes a hell of a mess of our finances.
Say that again. That's a really important point. All those toxic assets are still out there.
They're still out there, and guess what? We own them.
How long, then, until this debt overhang is done with?
Well, who knows? You know, it took us 10 years at least to get into this mess, so we shouldn't be too surprised if it takes us just as long to get out of it.
Patty Hirsch, our senior editor and creator, founder, and chief executive officer of the Marketplace Whiteboard. Patty, thanks.
Thank you.
2008 was like the bottom, and now it's just like another dip. But, you know, you might as well have faith.
From Chicago, Illinois, that was Jay Roderick. So you want the economy to grow? That's easy. Just get people back to work.
It's key right now for the government to step in and figure out how to help us create jobs. How can we do this? What do you need? A tax break? An incentive?
The ins and outs of what it takes to make a job. Unemployment as seen by a job seeker and a job giver. And the future of the labor market. That's coming up on The Breakdown, a Marketplace special on Our Economy One Step at a time. That's from APM, American Public Media. This is Marketplace, a special report, The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time. I'm Kai Ryssdal, glad to have you with us. So listen, do this for me, will you? Forget about stock market ups and downs. Ignore the political debates over deficits and spending cuts. And think for a second about what truly matters in this economy. J-O-B-S, jobs, work for the millions of Americans who don't have it. It's the fundamental economic fundamental. So we're going to spend this chunk of the program talking about it. As you've no doubt heard, we're in a jobless recovery. Our unemployment rate is 9.1%, and job growth is actually slowing down. So, first, a reality check. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has this story on job creation 2 years after the recession ended.
Imagine a new reality show. It's called Hey, America, Get a Job. And it has this edgy yet upbeat music. And here's our first contestant.
My name is Brittany Reichard. I'm 22. I live in Oregon, and I've got a job.
Brittany is one of the winners. And now she talks about the long odds she faced and how consistent persistence helped her land an entry-level marketing job in her field, environmental science.
The adults in the job industry are staying in their jobs longer. Young people coming out of college don't have a place to really fit in. And so it's just kind of keeping your arms open and trying to reach whatever you can out in the job market.
Her employer, meanwhile, could be a winner on reality TV, too. The company, called Columbia Green, has been growing by leaps and bounds. It's a roofing manufacturer that installs plants and soil on top of commercial buildings to filter stormwater. The green roofs can save building owners a lot of money on wastewater disposal and energy. Vanessa Kaitchis bought the business 2 years ago.
Our products went national and most recently international with Canada, Europe, and New Zealand.
Kaitchis expects revenues to hit $3 million this year and $15 million by 2013. She'll double the office staff to 12 next year. But this reality show celebrating job creation, well, it may not have a very long run. Because as much as we cheer for the few companies that are growing, it's not enough, not nearly enough.
Actually, I don't think we've seen any decent job growth since the recovery allegedly started back in June of 2009.
William Dunkelberg is chief economist at the National Federation of Independent Business.
Just to keep up with population growth, you need about 125,000 net new jobs every month. Then if you want to reemploy the 8 million people that we fired during the recession, we need well over 300,000 jobs.
That's every month for at least the next 3 years. Recently, we've been adding just 70,000 jobs a month. While healthcare, hospitality, and manufacturing have been hiring, everything connected to housing, from construction to real estate, has been stuck in the mud. Still, with corporate profits up and companies sitting on piles of cash, why aren't they using some of that to hire up? Dunkelberg says it's a simple matter of not enough demand in the economy for goods and services, especially from consumers.
The problem with the weak consumer spending that we have is that the likelihood of a new employee being able to generate enough additional value to the company, sales or whatever, is pretty low, and so there's no good reason to hire.
And so many reasons not to hire. I caught up with David Allison at the factory he owns in suburban Chicago. Jet Finishers has about 50 employees and does industrial coating for tractors, military vehicles, and consumer electronics. Allison laid off a third of his workers in 2009. Since then, business is up and the factory's humming, but
the people we have hired when we've needed extra hands, we brought them from a staffing agency because we're just loath to bring anyone on permanently.
What would make you think twice about what you just said?
You know, that's tough. I've been thinking about this myself. It really comes down to how I feel about the future. We did hire a couple of people. We did make that decision, and I ended up letting one of them go again. What would have to happen is we have to see some sense that the growth is permanent, not just a temporary blip.
There's no shortage of ideas for pushing business owners like Allison off the fence and into hiring mode. Many in the business community support a payroll tax cut for employers, for instance. That would shave a bit off the cost of adding workers to your payroll.
I don't think a few percentage points one way or the other on a payroll tax is going to make any difference.
An employer tax cut would also add to U.S. government debt. Cheaper ideas include boosting exports, which are already a bright spot for the U.S. economy. President Obama says ratification of free trade agreements would create jobs in the manufacturing and service sectors. Another proposal, give immigrant entrepreneurs a startup visa to settle here if they create jobs. Many Democrats are calling for another round of spending on roads, bridges, schools. That would mean paychecks for laid-off construction workers and, most likely, a bigger deficit. Stimulus dollars have kept the 400 union workers at Oregon Iron Works outside Portland busy right through the recession, cranking out massive bridge fittings, boats, and streetcars. As that funding runs out, company vice president Chandra Brown worries about a drop-off in business. At all costs, she wants to avoid layoffs.
So I tell you what, even in the downturn, we are going to keep our best people. That's our number one responsibility, is to keep our currently fantastically trained welders and fitters, machines that you can't even find anymore.
It's unlikely any of the ideas now being floated would generate the 300,000 jobs we need every month to dig out of the unemployment hole. And with the economy actually slowing down, the best hope may simply be that companies don't start downsizing yet again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I think high unemployment is affecting people who are younger, so that it's taking us longer to settle into a professional career.
That was Morgan Mall-Smith from Kerr Alice, Montana. So, as Mitchell just pointed out, maybe the best hope for the job market is for corporate status quo, meaning companies aren't going to lay anybody off, and the unemployment rate will stick right where it is, about 9%. But the thing about that number is that it's an average. There are plenty of places where unemployment's a lot higher. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from where job creation has simply disappeared.
One thing Baltimore still has going for it is its public markets, where stalls sell fresh produce, meat, and fish. At Northeast Market in East Baltimore, I found Dwayne Robertson eating clams off the shell with horseradish and a splash of hot sauce.
Yeah, I like hot spicy stuff.
Robertson's 48. He supports a three-year-old daughter with unemployment checks and odd jobs, lives with his sister. He lost his job as a maintenance worker almost a year ago.
Online, I may have like 200-300 applications. In the street, I may have about 75, and all the applications I've put in, I may have had 4 interviews.
In this part of town, unemployment is well over 20%, but most people older than 16 aren't even in the workforce.
Everybody is basically unemployed, especially most of the males. There's no work for them. They have a lot of programs, like job readiness programs, but they're not helping them find jobs, because I've been through like maybe 3 of those, and still I'm unemployed.
Lucinda Brown has a job in a supermarket part-time, making $7.50 an hour. But like a lot of people here, she never really noticed the recovery. Have you seen any improvement in the economy over the last couple years?
Not one bit. It's still the same, and if it ain't the same, it's getting worse.
Brown is 27, a single mom supporting 2 kids. She'd love to move to a better neighborhood, but can't afford to.
The crime rate goes up. Theft is basically the highest. I done seen somebody snatch money from an old lady and took off. So it's bad.
Do you feel safe with your kids here?
No, I don't feel safe at all. That's why I stay in the house unless I'm going to work.
You feel safe at work?
No.
East Baltimore is struggling, not from the latest recession, but from decades of losing population and jobs.
When you're talking about urban distressed neighborhoods, you're talking about areas that are only marginally attached to the national economy, so they can't get much worse than 20% unemployment.
Richard Clinch is director of economic research at the University of Baltimore's Jacob France Institute. He says what the recession did was halt some of the recovery that was underway here.
And should we go into a double dip, which is looking somewhat likely now, you can see development activities that were starting to restart in some of these communities stop.
So what does long-term unemployment look like? Block after block of boarded-up buildings, crime, drugs, failing schools.
You ever look down the street and you see them open lots? this whole area is just going to crumble until somebody says, okay, we got some jobs available, let's get back to work.
Harry Bennett is out of work. He's eating lake trout, a Baltimore specialty. Bennett is an engineer trained to build computers, but his last job was selling paint at Home Depot. He's 65 and finally started drawing Social Security after his unemployment benefits ran out.
That's the only income that I have right now. I mean, I feel like I've been robbed because I have a lot of knowledge. I cannot use it, and I can't give it away because nobody wants it.
And it'll take a much stronger national recovery to put people like Bennett back to work. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I mean, I'll be honest, I'm just glad to have a job and, you know, be able to pay my bills. And once I have a job, I'm pretty much fine.
Dion Rodriguez there from Brooklyn, New York. At this point, you might rightly be asking yourself this question. We've heard about the jobless recovery and a place where there are no jobs to be had, but surely there are some new jobs out there, aren't there? And in fact, you'd be right. The American economy did indeed add 117,000 jobs last month, all of them from the private sector. Marketplace Jennifer Collins explains how one of those new jobs came to be.
Bob White's family has owned a small manufacturing company in an L.A. suburb for more than 50 years. White's business, Janda Company, employs 23 people.
We make machines that will make your shopping carts, machines that will make bumpers, machines that make parts for Boeing or Lockheed for the aerospace industry.
Last November, orders for those machines quadrupled. White started running the company 10 hours a day and on Saturdays, but he debated adding to his payroll.
Do we really need to hire that person, or should we just work more hours, or, you know, why should we hire that person?
Janda is one of 29 million small businesses in the U.S. These companies employ half of all workers in the country. Many are struggling to grow. That's according to Pepperdine University professor John Paglia.
The primary concern of business owners in this economy is access to capital.
Loans and lines of credit. The Obama administration has promised $22 billion in loan guarantees for small businesses. Private banks loan most of that money.
They're having a tough time sorting through the applications for these small business owners because of the spotty recent financial performance.
Paglia says banks want to see a boost in revenue before they make loans. And because of the recession, few businesses can show cash flow, so they can't get the money to grow and hire.
Do you have any examples of people who have, or businesses that have been successful in adding jobs?
This is Paglia's actual pause. Now, keep in mind, he surveys hundreds of small businesses for Pepperdine.
No. Let me think for a minute.
Back at Janda Company, Bob White was still resistant to hire. That is, until he started falling behind on orders for equipment.
Going crazy. It's like, we need more help. We just can't get the product out.
In desperation, he reached out to Joe Talley, the grandson of a current worker. Talley had been unemployed for over a year.
My grandpa called and said, get your butt down here, you got a job. So showed up and started working.
Now he's learning to weld and getting other on-the-job training.
Doing whatever they tell me to do and watching them do it and trying to learn it myself.
And you'll be here for as long as you can.
As long as they'll let me stay.
So Talley has a job, but his boss, Bob White, is cautious about creating another.
Because I'm afraid to hire someone. Once we hire someone today, then all of a sudden, you know, 6 months downstream, we start slowing up again. We don't want to have to lay that person off.
And other business owners may be feeling that anxiety, too. A recent survey from Gallup shows 16% of small business owners expect to hire in the next year. That number is about half of what it was in January. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
I've had friends who are very concerned that their jobs might disappear if they put in very long hours because they don't want to be laid off.
Richard Kahn in Meredith, New Hampshire. In a lot of ways, the story of jobs in this country is a straight story of numbers. And any way you slice it, the numbers are just dismal. Nearly 14 million Americans are out of work. Half of them have been looking for a job for more than a year. Another 3 million people are what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls marginally attached. They want to work, they're available to work, but they can't find the hours. So what's going to happen in the places we've been this hour? Baltimore, Oregon, Los Angeles. Marketplace's Scott Tong has spent some time this year looking at the future of jobs in this country. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
So, Scott, remind us how big is the jobs hole and you know, what does it look like?
Well, it looks a little like the number 12, and here's what that means. By one measure, we need to create 12 million jobs in the U.S. economy to get back to pre-recession levels. And at a pace of about 200,000 new jobs per month, which is actually pretty good compared to what we've seen, it would take 12 years. So call it whatever you want. It's quite a hole. But here's what economists call the structural thing here. The jobs of tomorrow that we're hopefully going to create will probably not look like yesterday's jobs. A lot of labor economists say we've lost jobs in the middle, that is, that require middle skills, say you have a high school education but maybe not a full college degree, and they command middle wages. Economist David Otter over at MIT studies jobs that involve a lot of what he calls routine. You attach a windshield on a car in a factory over and over again. You're a bank teller. You're a typist. Those jobs, he says, are gone for good.
It raises the possibility that there will be missing rungs in the career ladder, if you will. If you think about good blue-collar production jobs or office administrative support jobs, those were often career occupations. They were things that offered stability and certainly a sustainable standard of living.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Scott, and it's basically, you know, technology replacing people instead of lower-wage workers overseas, and I get that. But the big question this week is, how did we get here? What happened that made this change come?
Well, this is a long story. I mean, technology giveth, technology taketh away. It goes all the way back at least 200 years to England when mechanical looms threatened human weavers. And we all get 10 points for remembering those are the Luddites.
Mm-hmm.
And in the American South, right, technology and railroads and electricity took good jobs from the Northeast, the expensive Northeast, to the cheaper South. Today, of course, we have the internet technology, which challenges the old school middlemen and the salesmen, of course. Many say the big change began in the 91 recession, when lots of these routine jobs in the middle didn't come back when the economy came back. And now this is looking like the third straight recession that looks like that.
So here's the question for the next year in American politics. Where does job growth come from? How do you do that?
Labor economists look at what they see now, and they see growth at the top as doctors, software writers, petroleum engineers, and a lot of them at the bottom, home health care aides, dog walkers, people who mow lawns, the bottom of the income scale. And there are a lot of people, of course, who are chasing those jobs, so those wages aren't going to go up very quickly. I mean, we risk oversimplifying, but a lot of people describe it as an hourglass economy, and that's going to be what it kind of looks like for a while.
What do you do then, Scott?
Well, this is where we collide into politics. Many say we invest in education because there's a lot of numbers that say a bachelor's degree translates into a big and increasing wage premium is what they call it. A lot of countries are investing public dollars into new sectors where they hope a lot of these jobs in the middle are. Biotech, clean tech, infrastructure to shore up some of these jobs and create new ones going forward.
Ambitious government programs at a time when government is getting less ambitious.
Well, and that's the question. There are a lot of programs, a lot of tax incentives that try to create these things, but we're in a budget environment where, you know, those tend not to be on the table. So tough calls going forward.
Scott Tong on the jobs picture for us. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I do think America's place in the world is changing. I don't think we're the king of the world anymore.
Bill Jones from Seattle, Washington. This is a global economy, you know, so it's more than goods and services that cross borders, debt from other countries and how that's playing in our policy after the break. And could three little letters really have changed the economic game?
It's kind of embarrassing, though, because, you know, the United States has basically had a prime credit rating throughout just about all of our history. It's kind of sad that after 220 years, we appear to be less than AAA.
Credit ratings, downgrades, and debt. Oh my, that's coming up on The Breakdown, a Marketplace special on our economy, one step at a time. It's from APM, American Public Media. We're back with a Marketplace special broadcast, The Breakdown, Our Economy, One Step at a Time. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you with us. The past 3 or 4 years have not been kind to the American economy. There's the real damage done by the implosion of the housing market and the financial crisis, of course. But then you throw on top of that the more abstract notion of our place in the world, our global economic reputation, if you will. And to be honest, that's not too good right now. The S&P downgrade a couple of weeks ago didn't help that any. And no, there's not really much of a practical difference between AAA and AA+, but it's the thought that counts. So it stands to reason we'd want to get that AAA back. But how? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Horwich.
Let's tell it like it is, Uncle Sam. Your credit score took a hit. Hey, millions of us have been there. Who are they, some self-appointed company, to pass judgment on how reliable you are? It bites. But let's get a little perspective from someone who sees people in your boat every day. Daryl Dahlheimer at LSS Financial Counseling says it's not like you've just trashed your credit.
You might even say it's more like someone who has an 800 score, a fantastic chart-topping score in personal credit, going to a 750. They're still qualifying for every activity, but maybe they feel a little worse about having the fewer points.
Still, you want to get that AAA back. But first, you got to work through some serious issues. Chad Gearing at CPR Credit Services sees it all the time.
You got a husband and a wife who come in. She really thinks they need to cut expenses. He likes spending money, and so he thinks he's just got to earn more money. The first thing I tell him is you have to get on the same page.
Yeah, tell that to Democrats and Republicans in a campaign year.
I have a fairly, I guess, pessimistic outlook of the road back to AAA, so to speak.
Gennady Goldberg is Treasury's analyst at market analysis firm Forecast. S&P not only downgraded U.S. debt, it placed it on so-called negative outlook. Goldberg says that means a multiple-step program before we get our old rating back.
So by 2013, we might get rid of the negative outlook. So they might reaffirm a stable one. What they'll do then is put us on positive outlook, which will take quite a bit of time and probably a bit of political clout to convince the S&P that Congress means business at this point.
But wait now, didn't we just get a deal and achieve some domestic harmony? Let's look at the numbers. Just before the downgrade, S&P floated a target of $4 trillion in cuts to the federal budget. That's what it called a good down payment on preventing a debt spiral where interest payments run out of control down the road. Goldberg says the deal we just got nets us, at most, $2.4 trillion.
So we're about halfway there. S&P kind of took a look at how difficult it was to even get half of those cuts and said, you know, this might not be very feasible going forward.
Goldberg says best case scenario, a focused and productive Congress might claw our way back to an S&P AAA rating by 2016. Economist Richard Silla at NYU's Stern School of Business is more upbeat.
Well, I'm guessing that it may not take that long.
Silla says the good news is S&P's justification was essentially political. If political winds shift, it will be compelled to revisit the rating.
That will by itself take away one of the main reasons we got downgraded.
But he also wonders whether we should even care. S&P's actions seem to have no effect on the U.S. Treasuries it downgraded. In fact, Silla says they became more valuable as investors looked for something safe.
Longer run, if we don't get out from under the AA rating, we may have to pay a slightly higher interest rate, but it's not the end of the world.
He's not suggesting we ignore the deficit, but in a practical sense, Silla says we could live with AA+, probably forever. Lots of countries do.
It's kind of embarrassing, though, because, you know, the United States has basically had a prime credit rating throughout just about all of our history. It's kind of sad that after 220 years, we appear to be less than AAA.
And there it is, the insecurity, the insult of being slapped with a credit score that's less than pristine. And just like you or me, Silla says if we really want to get there, the road back to top-notch credit is paved with compromise and sacrifice. No way around it. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
But I think as far as economically, you know, we can't compete with countries that have a lot cheaper labor and a lot more people.
Sarah Mansfield, out of Atlanta, Georgia. Let me pick up on Jeff's story about the S&P downgrade and ask you this question. So what? Plenty of countries have been downgraded before. Canada, Australia, Japan a decade ago, and then again earlier this year. And in fact, S&P said the same things about Japan that it did about us. High debt, slow growth, political bickering. A learning opportunity for us, perhaps? Roland Burke is the BBC's correspondent in Tokyo. Mr. Burke, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Remind us of the state of the Japanese economy when they got downgraded 10-some-odd years ago.
Well, the Japanese have been downgraded since then as well, earlier this year. The problem, essentially, is that Japan's economy has been stagnating for 20 years after a big crash. The government has been spending enormous sums of money trying to jolt the economy into life with stimulus measures. That hasn't really worked. And over the years, that means that Japan has built up a massive public debt, the biggest as a proportion of the size of its economy in the industrialized world. And that's the reason why Japan has been downgraded several times, because the agencies say, look, nothing's being done to fix that situation.
Before its most recent immediate downgrade, how long did it take Japan to get its credit rating back up?
Well, Japan hasn't got its credit rating back up, but the fundamental problem, I think these credit ratings, it's not the cause of the problem. It's a symptom of what's going on. It's a warning of what's going on. It's a sign that the ratings agencies don't believe that the country can get a grip on its problems. When you look at Japan, it's spending more than it receives. There's a political impasse that means the reforms to tax and social welfare that economists think are necessary is very difficult to do. And that's the reason why the ratings agencies lose confidence in the country.
We hear a lot in this country the last year or so about the lost decade and how, oh my God, we're another Japan. Do you buy that?
I think that's a pretty convincing argument when you look at what's happening in Western countries. What happened in Japan back at the end of the 1980s was that there was a massive crash. They'd had a boom. They'd had good times all through the 1980s. And then they just never managed to get the economy back on track because all the banks were too indebted. People's own households were too indebted as well. So everybody spent a long time trying to get their balance sheets back in shape, trying to get their heads back above the water. And you get a kind of situation in a country like Japan when that happens, when it's a kind of spiral going down. There's a constant race in shops to make things cheaper, wages are going down, and everything goes flat. And I find it a pretty convincing argument that the United States is going to go through that too.
Back to the issue of downgrades and credit ratings. You were pointing out that it's not a cause, it's a symptom. And in Japan's case, it was because the mechanics of the economy don't work. Our downgrade was because the politics of our economy don't work. Is there a way to fix that other than some kind of systemic overhaul here?
Well, certainly Japan has struggled to fix that. In a sense, in Japan, it has also been the mechanics of the economy haven't been fixed by the politicians. There just doesn't seem to be a way for the two main parties here to get together and actually resolve the issues that are facing the country. And really, over the years, as the economy has been flat, as the pressure has grown, as the debt has got bigger, it seems it's become tougher for the politicians to get together and make those difficult decisions, not more easy. And I think for Americans, that might sound like a familiar situation.
Is Japan and its economic situation a good analog for the United States? Should we be thinking about what happened over there?
I think Japan is definitely a warning to a number of countries in the world, definitely to the United States. It's a warning of what happens when booms get out of control and when borrowing gets out of control. One thing that is worth saying is that when people in places like the United States talk about the Japanese economy, it's always doom and gloom. But maybe something that could give hope to people in the United States is that life for ordinary people here is actually pretty good. You know, unemployment is very low. It's a very civilized country. It looks like a very wealthy country. It's a very orderly country as well. So I think the thing about Japan is that although its economy has been flat, things have kept going along for the ordinary people here. And perhaps that's something that could give hope to people in America.
Roland Burke with the BBC in Tokyo. Mr. Burke, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
My day-to-day spending habits are so minimal at this point because we're trying to get back on our feet.
Trevor Fisher in Des Moines, Iowa. So look, at least we've got this going for us. We're not the only ones in a big heap of debt trouble. In fact, you can make the case that the United States looks pretty good because a lot of big other Western economies look pretty bad. That'd be Europe in particular. But this isn't really the time for schadenfreude, to be honest. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the line with us now from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So this Eurozone debt crisis that you and I have talked about oh so many times before, how much of it is the residue, the sticky, sticky residue of 2008 and what happened then?
This is the second leg of that crisis. Mm. We had subprime, we had the credit crunch, banks refusing to lend to each other. because of the interconnectedness of the US and the European banks, we had the credit crunch here too. So banks lost money, governments had to bail them out. All this sounds very familiar. Deficits widened, recession and stimulus packages and even bigger deficits. And then at the beginning of last year, investors here started fretting about the size of European government debt. And that spiraled into the Eurozone debt crisis.
Do I overstate the case if I posit that what you guys are having over there, in essence, is our fault from over here?
No, not entirely. It was triggered in America, but it's been hugely compounded in Europe, specifically because of the interconnection between the 17 countries that make up the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. They all, the strong and the weak economies, are yoked together by a common currency. And that has magnified the problem. That's made it easier for trouble in one country's financial markets to spread to another.
All right, you have to explain that because I thought, and the selling point of the euro 12, 13 years ago, whatever it was that the single currency would enable Europe to grow together and weather the storms. But clearly that's not the case.
It was based on two assumptions, which turned out to be false. I mean, first of all, that the 17 economies, as they now are, would in time converge and begin to achieve similar levels of performance, of productivity and competitiveness. That hasn't happened. Germany, for example, has remained streets ahead of other countries like Greece, Portugal and Ireland. The other assumption was that there would be this strength in numbers. They'd be united. It would be like the Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all. That turned out to be not entirely true. There's been a huge crisis here, as we've talked about over the months, about whether rich Euro members like Germany should bail out the weaker ones like Greece. Three countries have been bailed out, but we're getting to the point now where the Germans are saying, no more bailouts, please.
What happens then? I mean, is there a, to use the geopolitical phrase, a pan-European solution?
Well, that's what everyone's hoping for. And this is what people are turning to France and Germany for. But it doesn't appear on the horizon. The big next fear is that Spain and Italy may have to be bailed out. At the moment, the European Central Bank is propping up the bonds of these countries. They'll probably do that until the end of September, when, if all goes to plan, the new bailout fund will take over the job. But it'll only have about $400 billion in it or so. And Italy has issued something like $2.5 trillion worth of debt. So the bailout fund could run out of money very quickly. The big question then will be, will the Germans in particular put their hands in their pockets and stump up more cash? That would be the ultimate solution. We'll know that by October. I suspect the crunch will come in October. The Eurozone debt crisis will reach some kind of crescendo in October.
You're a lovely man, Stephen, but I don't believe you because we have talked I don't know how many times over the past 6 or 8 months or a year about the end of the Eurozone crisis, and it just keeps on going.
It does, but we have to be reaching some kind of end game because the focus now is on the big Eurozone countries like Spain and Italy. And there simply are not the resources there at the moment to bail these countries out. If these countries default, then to put it in a nutshell, they'll be hell to pay.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
Stephen talked a little bit about the European Central Bank and how the ECB's had its hands full trying to backstop all the bad debt over there. Here, that unenviable task falls to the Federal Reserve and its use of what's technically called monetary policy. Interest rates are a much easier way to think about that. Last week, the Fed said flat out that short-term rates are going to stay near zero for another 2 years as it does what it can do to goose the economy. The idea is that lower interest rates will lead to growth, lower mortgage costs, cheaper for companies to borrow, maybe more hiring, which would be great if it all works. But low rates are not without their complications. If you've got money in CDs or savings accounts, for instance, you're not going to make a lot of money off your money. Thomas Honig is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Until last year, he was a member of the Federal Open Market Committee as well. That's the part of the Fed that sets those short-term interest rates. Mr. Honig, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
Had you had your way last year and been able to convince the board at the FOMC to raise interest rates, What would be happening in the economy right now? I mean, how would that have played out?
No one knows. It's a counterfactual. But what I'm saying is that I was not in favor of high interest rates. There's a difference.
Yep, yep.
I was in favor of taking it off zero because zero is misallocating credit. Who wants to save at zero? What you do is you encourage further leverage in a country that is already highly leveraged.
More borrowing.
Yes. And I asked the question, can you name me a product, can you name me a service that trades well, that allocates resources well at a price of zero? And the answer has uniformly been no. So why would you expect credit to be different?
Right.
All I was saying is a modest increase so we begin to let the markets decide where resources ought to be allocated. And in doing that, take away the uncertainty about the future in the sense of everyone's now worried about what the inflation outbreak will mean for them.
Has not the Fed, though, taken away the uncertainty for the future? They said the other day, we're going to keep rates low till 2013. You guys are secure in that.
My own view is that they've actually increased the uncertainty because what does that mean? You mean to tell me that we have to stay at zero for another 2 years? Is the economy that bad? People are asking that question. And then they're saying with that, well, what does it mean for inflation? And that's why you see the price of gold, I think, moving up very rapidly, commodities who've paused now, I think, I fear will rise depending on how the economy itself does. So what I fear, I hope I'm wrong, but what I fear is that we've increased uncertainty, not removed it.
What should the role of consumers be in this economy?
The consumer is the citizen, and they have to buy goods and services, and they want to be able to do it in an environment where prices are stable. But I don't think the consumer can bail out all issues, because here's one of the things that's happened in this country. The consumer used to amount to about two-thirds, 66% of our gross domestic product. And as we move through the boom, it moved all the way to 70%. So we were relying on the consumer for much more of our growth in the economy. We were not saving as much. And to do that, we were borrowing from the rest of the world, so it increased our debt to the rest of the world. You're consuming more than you're producing. And what we need to be thinking about in this country is how do we reemphasize production enough to meet reasonably our needs, enough to export to the rest of the world so that we're now balanced, that we're consuming and producing in a line with one another. It's not easy to get there. It took us two decades to get where we are today. But to have that in mind so that we are a balanced economy and an industrial and consuming leader of the world as we once were.
Thomas Hoenig is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Mr. Hoenig, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Good to be with you.
When I'm in the grocery store, or, you know, you just sort of look and say, well, do we really need that?
That was Katie Lizarraga from Franklin, Tennessee, right there. The Breakdown from Marketplace, Our Economy One Step at a Time, was produced by Nancy Fargali, Fiona Ng, Jonathan Karp, Doug Krisner, and Brendan Willard. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. You can hear the latest news of business, economics, personal finance, and technology on all the Marketplace programs. That'd be Marketplace, the Marketplace Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and the Marketplace Tech Report. And you can always catch up on what you might have missed online at marketplace.org. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks so much for being with us. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.